This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Fisher King, a Jack McBride mystery, by Melissa Lenhart, narrated by P.J. Oakland. In olden times, the Fisher King was charged with keeping the Grail. When the Fisher King was blighted by a wound that wouldn't heal, castles fell down, and the land around was made infertile. There, he lived in a wasteland until the knight Percival came to the castle in search of the Holy Grail. Percival healed the king, and the land burst into blossom, and a time of plenty began. Part 1. Secrets and Lies. Chapter 1. Fred Muldoon needed new shoes. Leaves and twigs worked their way through the hole in the sole of his right shoe as he walked the woods behind Doyle Industries. He stopped at the chain-link fence and stared at the gravel lot, dreading the journey across its uneven surface to his home for the night. He hadn't drunk enough to ignore the pain those damn rocks would put him through, lodging as they would beneath his big toe. Goddamn gout. He patted his coat pocket for his bottle of Old Crow. He could sit here against the fence, drink his whiskey. The night wasn't too cold, and this was as good a spot as any. He sat down against the sagging fence, unscrewed the cap, and lifted it to his lips. A low roll of thunder interrupted him. He took a quick gulp and replaced the bottle. He hated being wet. It used to be an occupational hazard for the town drunk, until Fred stole a pair of wire cutters and used them to cut a hole in a remote corner of Doyle Industries' fence. Between sleeping in the cabs of Doyle's trucks and earning whiskey money from telling Jack McBride innocent lies and useless information about the seedier side of Stillwater, Fred Muldoon hadn't had it this good since 1969. Tonight, Fred targeted his favorite Mack truck, which seemed to be doing longer and longer trips these past few weeks, if its regular absence from the truck yard was any indication. He climbed into the cab and settled down for the night, the smell of wintergreen snuff reminding him of his father. He considered his fifth of Old Crow. It might not be enough tonight. He took off his shoe and tried to flex his red, swollen toe. Goddamn gout. He lay down on the seat, propped his head on the armrest of the passenger door, and inspected his shoe. He'd had these shoes since the Reagan administration, and while the years told on the scuffed, faded leather, the uppers had 20 more on the measy. These shoes were the last good thing Fred bought before his slide down the bottle, and he was attached to them. He didn't cling to them as a tether to a better, more successful past, but Fred figured these shoes would be there when he found the bottom of the bottle or the grave, and he wanted something familiar to keep him company when he got there. Fred placed his shoe on his chest, drank his whiskey, and tried to imagine a way he could get to Yorkville to have them resold. He could probably hit the Methodist preacher up for a ride, and maybe even the cost of the souls. He'd have to stay sober to do it. Not an appealing thought at the moment. He'd worry about it later. The Old Crow wasn't going to drink itself. Fred was well on his way to being drunk when he heard the low voices. Though the truck was high enough, he couldn't be seen from the ground. Fred scrunched down into the seat anyway. He'd long since hocked his watch, and the security lights in the truck yard cut off any chance Fred had of telling time by the moon. Not a skill he was good at anyway. He figured it was past midnight. In his 70 years, he'd discovered most bad shit happened after midnight. Though muffled from the closed door and window, the voices were clear enough Fred could hear every word. He grinned and cuddled his bottle closer. He'd have enough money to buy its replacement, or two, very soon.
I'm telling you, I don't trust him.
And I'm telling you, I don't give a shit.
Fred's ears perked up at the sound of a woman's voice. He didn't need to see her to know who she was.
You're only saying that because you're fucking him.
Fred shifted in the seat, not particularly wanting to hear more. His shoe dropped to the floorboard with a thud.
Did you hear something?
The woman said. Fred froze and pressed himself further down into the seat. If the woman stepped on the running board and peeked into the cab, he wouldn't live long enough to finish his old crow.
Don't change the subject.
Fred's body sagged with relief. He sucked down the rest of his bottle, in case it was his last.
Why would I change the subject? You're the one who sounds like an ass, not me.
You're unbelievable.
Jealousy doesn't become you.
The man snorted.
I'll explain it again,
the woman said as though talking to a child.
Having the chief's brother in our organization works to our advantage. If McBride takes us down, which won't happen, then he'll take his brother down with us. Pollard said McBride and his mother have bailed Eddie out of scrapes for 20 years.
They won't bail him out forever. Everyone has a breaking point.
You speaking from experience? Maybe you should take some time off.
So McBride can waltz into my place? I don't think so.
The woman sighed.
God, why are men so fucking needy?
I'm not needy. I just don't trust Eddie McBride.
Well, I do.
Why?
I asked him to do something, and he did it.
What?
It doesn't concern you. Don't forget who's in charge. Are you done pouting?
After a pause, she said,
Good. I need you to set up a meeting with the Pedrosas.
Why?
Because kids are overdosing on their dirty heroin, and I'm going to put a stop to it.
You think they're going to stop selling because you say please?
No. I'm going to offer a truce.
They're going to smell blood if you do.
I hope so. That's when you let Jack McBride pick you up. He's been looking for you for weeks.
What? I'm not going back to jail.
You won't. You'll make a deal. The Pedrosas, in return for an easy sentence. You'll get out, come back, and I'll give you the Cypress County operation.
The whole thing?
Everything. Numbers, girls, drugs. Imagine taking it to your grand wizard. Y'all can fund your cause for years.
Chris won't like giving up the numbers.
She laughed.
He'll do what he's told.
What about Eddie?
Fred heard a rustling, and the timbre of the woman's voice dropped. He almost didn't hear her next comment.
He's our protection from McBride.
I've seen the way you look at him.
The clink of a belt being released. Then the man said,
Fucking's your answer to everything, isn't it?
You've never complained before.
The man moaned, and besides the sound of feet scraping for purchase on the gravel, Fred heard nothing for a full minute. He lifted his head from his prone position and saw the top of a man's head pressed against the door of the truck, his hand grasping the side view mirror as though hanging on for dear life. Fred lay his head back down and grinned. Someone was getting their pole shined. He might as well join in, if his old pecker would cooperate. Never a sure thing these days. He tucked his empty bottle between him and the seat back and went to work. Fred was at last getting somewhere in his efforts when he heard the man let out a long, low groan, followed by the distinctive sound of spitting.
Eddie will bring our next shipment in on Friday.
That's my run.
You're too important to be an errand boy. You have to get in touch with the Pedrosas and set up a meeting.
I don't know. A lot can go wrong in this plan.
If it goes right, we can get rid of two birds with one stone.
The Pedrosas and who?
Jack McBride.
Chapter 2. The house needed little coaxing to go up in flames. 100 years worth of weather and Texas heat had baked the clapboard house to a brittle shell. It stood more from habit and memory than the skill of the one-armed doughboy who built the house on his return to Stillwater from the Great War. 50 years of heartbreak, shell shock, the Great Depression, another war, and old age, and the soldier had died alone, willing the house and land to a woman no one had ever heard of or bothered to try to find. The house and land lay fallow and forgotten, blocked from sight by bushes and brush, until only Stillwater lifers knew a neat little craftsman was once out Old Stillwater Highway, just past the city limits, near the river. Volunteer firemen soaked the surrounding field with water, more concerned with wildfire prevention and saving the pastures next door than an old ramshackle house long rumored to be a haven for hobos, hippies, Satanists, wetbacks, or meth heads, depending on the decade. Stillwater Chief of Police Jack McBride, 8 weeks on the job, knew none of the history as he stood back, watching the heat pulse like a heartbeat on the fringe of the fire's aura. The mud-colored smoke hovered, as if reluctant to leave, before giving up and fading in the gray November dusk.
Jack?
Jack turned from the smoldering house to see Sheriff Ann Newberry approaching. As if on cue, the house's stone chimney collapsed into the scorched front yard. Ann, what brings you to Stillwater during rush hour? He glanced at the steady stream of rubberneckers being directed past the scene by his two new deputies. I hope you stopped by to take the case off my hands. It's outside city limits, after all.
Doesn't look like there'll be much to investigate.
Nope.
Think it was deliberate? A belated Halloween prank?
Jack took a deep breath. He coughed. Smell that? Anne lifted her nose. She was experienced enough to know the smell of burning flesh buried beneath wood and brush.
Christ. Let's hope it's dead animals we're smelling.
Anne turned her head away and coughed.
Why I'm really here is to tell you we've finished with Pollard's journals. I've brought you copies so you don't have to drive to Yorkville every night.
6 weeks earlier, on suspicion of long-running corruption, Jack and Dan had searched former Stillwater Chief of Police Buck Pollard's house. Their disappointment at not finding trunks of cash and a ledger detailing who paid what and when dissipated when they found county police files, long thought lost, boxes of journals written in Pollard's hand going back 40 years, and child porn on his computer. The next day, word had come from the Coast Guard. Pollard's boat had been found in the Gulf of Mexico, capsized in a September storm. Pollard's body had never been found.
You didn't need to do that, Jack said.
You like spending every night in the Yorkville crime lab reading a dead man's journals?
I mean, I could have sent Starling down to get them.
Well, I wanted some fish at Mabel's, Anne said.
I'm partial to her fried chicken.
You can't go wrong with either.
A lull followed, and Anne said,
So tomorrow we tell the others.
Because they weren't sure how far and wide across York County Buck Pollard's corruption reached, only a handful of people knew about the search and seizure. Surprisingly, not a word had leaked. A silence that started out as a test of Jack's senior deputy, Sergeant Minor Jessen's loyalty, ended up being the confirmation that not everyone in York County was beholden to Pollard. Though sometimes it felt like it. Tomorrow they would tell the other York County police chiefs about what they'd found and hope they didn't resent being kept in the dark for almost 2 months. A tall, thin policeman with lank hair sticking out from under his Stetson walked over to Jack and Dan. Sheriff? Chief? Even though Jack saw him every day, Miner stuck out his hand. Jack wasn't sure if it was a sign of respect for his position as chief of police, or merely a habit of Miner's. the bone-deep installation of country manners into this thoroughly country man. Miner looked at the house, which had burned itself out in record time.
Suppose it's a blessing in disguise. The tweakers'll have to find another hangout. Drove by Willow Street on my way over. There's a 84 GMC parked back there that's registered to Paco Morales.
Name doesn't ring a bell, Jack said.
He stays out of trouble. Been around for 30 years or more. Was legalized back in 86. Was a regular at the Chevron, but's been working out at the country club for years now.
The same country club Joe Doyle owns, Jack said.
The same.
Willow Street? Ann asked.
Some will park back there and walk across the pasture so as not to park on the road. Draw attention, Miner said.
This Morales ever been picked up for drugs? Jack said.
Not to my knowledge. I'll run him to make sure, Miner replied.
Ann shrugged.
I've never heard of him.
The firemen roamed over the wreckage, checking for and dousing hot spots. Jack looked down at his square-toed dress shoes, his recent polishing shot to hell, and not for the first time realized he wasn't dressed for real police work, or at least the kind he'd been doing in Stillwater, Texas for the last 2 months. As if reading Jack's mind, Ann said,
There's a uniform shop on the square in Yorkville if you're in the market. It's going to be hell getting the smoke out of that wool suit and silk tie. If you want, I can walk around the house so you don't get your shoes dirty.
Ha ha. I'll go, Miner said.
When he was out of earshot, Ann asked Jack,
Debate starts soon. You gonna go?
I suppose I should as chief, but I can't vote, he said. Haven't lived here long enough.
Do I need to ask who you'd vote for?
The general consensus seemed to be Joe Doyle was about to be elected to the open city council seat. How it was even a contest, Jack didn't understand. Joe's opponent, Ellie York Martin, was a pillar of the community. Joe Doyle was outwardly a successful businessman. Behind the scenes, he was the biggest drug lord in York County. It had only been a theory of Jack's, until a week ago when he came across an entry in one of Pollard's journals that seemed to confirm it, justifying Jack spending the last 6 weeks holed up in the Yorkville crime lab, poring over the journals and tossing information to the DEA and FBI, who had been investigating Pollard for 6 months. Well, I sure as hell wouldn't vote for Joe Doyle. It was unconscionable to Jack for a crook like Doyle to hold a position of power, even in an insignificant small East Texas town like Stillwater.
Ellie doesn't stand much of a chance, I hear, Ann said.
I hear the same. Ann paused and said,
Anything ever happen there? With Ellie?
Jack jingled the keys and change in his pocket. Anything ever happen there? An easy question with a complicated answer. The firemen at the back of the smoldering ruin raised their arms and waved them over as Jack's phone rang. His wife's picture flashed on the screen. He almost ignored it, but figured it was better to get it over with and answered, as water sloshed over his shoes and seeped inside. Shit.
Nice, Julie said.
I'm not cussing at you. What is it, Julie? I'm at a scene.
I thought we were going to the debate together.
I'm working.
Really, Jack?
Yes, really. Would you like to talk to the fireman standing beside me putting out a fire?
I thought the whole point of hiring new people was so you didn't work as much.
Jack sighed. I'm still the chief, Julie. I have to go. We'll talk later.
Jack, don't hang...
Jack clicked off and put the phone in his pocket.
Problems at home?
Ann asked. Jack shook his head. Second verse, same as the first. Ann and Jack walked behind the wreckage and stopped next to Miner and the fire chief.
Shit,
Ann said. The fireman looked at Jack.
You seem to attract him, don't you?
The fireman walked off, leaving Jack, Ann, and Miner staring down at the charred, smoking remains of two bodies. Chapter 3. Jack left once the halogen lights were brought to the scene, so Simon Jones, the lead crime tech, could sweep for trace evidence as late into the night as need be. The scene would be active for hours yet, though the officers would spend most of the time standing around, waiting for other people to do their jobs. Jack thought to use the scene as a way to get out of attending the debate, but with three Stillwater cops and half a dozen county deputies standing around waiting for something to do, he couldn't justify it. He'd make a quick appearance at the debate and still be back in plenty of time to see the bodies tagged and bagged. Jack turned off Old Yorkville Highway and onto Boondoggle Road. In a nod to its founding by a lumber baron, Stillwater's streets were all unimaginatively named after trees, except Boondoggle Road. Only old-timers who remembered the fight against building the road during the post-war boom of the 50s said the name with any derision these days. Jack guessed the same residents who were against moving the main road a mile west of downtown back then would be voting on Tuesday for Doyle, the man who made his fortune from the move, and against Ellie, who wanted to pull businesses back downtown. Apparently, Doyle's supporters' nostalgia for the good old days rested more on the status quo than in revitalizing downtown, if it meant pulling in new residents and tourists. Outsiders. When he couldn't put it off any longer, Jack pulled into Stillwater High School's parking lot and went inside. He opened the front doors to the school and wrinkled his nose against the faint, tangy aroma of teenage body odor hovering in the air. Chris Ryan, Joe Doyle's son-in-law, watched the debate through the rectangular window in the auditorium door. Chris was stocky, with a big head and a bull neck, an athlete gone to seed. "Hi, Chris," Jack said. Chris jumped away from the door as though he'd been electrocuted. Confusion and fear flashed across his face before his expression fell into an easy grin.
"Hey, Chief, you scared me."
"Obviously." Chris was dressed in khakis and a Nike half-zip pullover and smelled of grass and sweat.
"Glad I ran into you," Jack said.
"You know Paco Morales?"
"Sure, he's one of my groundskeepers. Head one, in fact."
Chris wrinkled his nose and sniffed.
"Why do you smell like smoke?"
"Came from the fire out on 107. We found Morales' truck parked back on Willow Street behind DI.
You send Morales to corporate for anything?"
Chris turned his hat forward and shook his head.
"No. Seen Morales lately. Today, at work. Ever had any problem with him?"
The front door of the school opened and Minor Jessen entered.
"No, none. Very reliable."
"Why?
Do you think he's involved in the fire?"
Jack shrugged.
"His truck is abandoned where floppers tend to park."
Jack jerked his head toward the debate raging inside.
"Going in?" "I guess I have to. Michelle's already ballistic, I'm late. You?"
Miner walked up.
"Hi, Chris. How's your game?"
"I'm winning more than I'm losing."
"Can't complain about that, huh?"
Chris shrugged and entered. When the door closed, Jack turned to Miner.
"Let's go in the audio booth."
Jack knocked on a windowless door next to the auditorium door and opened it. A teenager swiveled in his chair as the two men entered. The kid's eyes widened and he pulled his headphones off.
"Sir?"
Jack pulled a couple of ones from his wallet.
"Take a 5-minute break. Get something from the vending machine."
Eyes bulging like golf balls, the kid took the money and bolted.
"What did you find?" Jack said.
"Esperanza Perez is Paco Morales' daughter."
Esperanza Perez had been an important part of solving Jack's first case in Stillwater, the murders of Gilberto and Rosa Ramos. She'd also been the alibi of their initial suspect, Diego Vasquez, who turned out to be the front man for the Pedrosa drug cartel, as well as the man who escaped Jack's custody his first day on the job. Every police department in York County had been searching for Diego for the last 8 weeks, and no one had been able to find him.
"What?"
"Yep. Said he hasn't come home. Usually gets home by 6 when it turns dark early. Sometimes he goes out again, but he never came home tonight.
She seemed worried.
She tried to hide it, but yeah. How soon will Jones get to the bodies?
He's sending them to Tyler, Jack said. It's beyond his scope. Said he'd try to rush the bullets and the trace evidence, but considering his backlog, he didn't promise anything. Apparently, the sheriff's department found a meth lab in some Dallas Oil Company executive's lake house. They cooked in it, but didn't do a good job of cleaning up. Miner watched the debate through the opaque glass.
Set up in a house that's rarely used, leave before they realize. No one's the wiser. Surprised it took them so long to think of it.
Maybe they're getting sloppy. Jack followed Miner's gaze, but pointedly avoided looking in Ellie's direction. Joe Doyle watched Ellie with a condescending smirk on his tanned face. With a full head of silver hair styled in an elaborate pompadour and his dark suit and power tie, Doyle looked like a televangelist and was about as trustworthy. Jack could look at Doyle's oily countenance for only so long. He stared down at the soundboard.
Want to hear what they're saying?
Miner pulled the headphone plug from the jack before Jack could reply. Ellie's whiskey-soaked voice filled the room. Jack focused on counting the number of bald spots in the audience until Joe Doyle started talking.
If you're such a pussy you can't even look at her, just leave, you idiot.
Jack jingled the keys in his pockets. He should leave. If he waited until the debate ended, he would get caught up with talking to residents, and coming face to face with Ellie was almost guaranteed. Considering the size of Stillwater, they had done an amazing job of avoiding each other since September, the day his wife came home. He was strong as long as he wasn't anywhere near Ellie, but he wasn't a fucking robot. He would leave. His mistake was glancing at Ellie as she pushed a strand of hair behind her right ear. He was swamped with the memory of the first time he saw the mannerism 2 months earlier, when he sat across the desk from her and talked about Stillwater history and signed mortgage papers. The ache in the center of his chest, the one he had done a pretty good job of ignoring for the past 6 weeks, intensified. Ellie's eyes left Joe Doyle and moved to the back of the auditorium before fixing on the smoky glass separating them.
What was I thinking?
Ellie stood on stage in her high school auditorium for the first time in 25 years and listened to Joe Doyle slyly dredge up every scandal of her life. It was, unfortunately, a long and varied list. Her mother's suicide. Her father's gambling, drinking, carousing, and his legendary hatred for his only child. Witnessing the suicide of her best friend on a Lake York dock in 1985. The point-shaving allegations from the 1988 Girls State Basketball Championship. Fertility problems. A lying, cheating husband who swindled Stillwater residents and was serving time in Huntsville. Divorce. Ellie doodled, "Fuck you, Joe Doyle," on her legal pad. She clicked her pen, put it down, and tried to hide her smile. She always wondered what politicians wrote during debates. Now she knew. Ellie's eyes roamed over the crowd. She knew everyone there. Figured 30% would vote for her out of pure spite for Doyle. If dredging up tired old scandals was the best Joe Doyle could do to discredit her, maybe this election wasn't... Oh, hell no. Did he call me a liberal? Ellie removed her glasses and pushed her hair behind her ear. If that wasn't the nail in the coffin of her ill-advised campaign, she didn't know what was. She should probably listen to what Doyle was saying, but what was the use? She wasn't going to win. She knew it. Everyone in this auditorium knew it. They all came tonight to witness her inevitable humiliation at Doyle's hands. There was too much in her history to overcome the modicum of respect she had been able to build over the last 10 years. She knew plenty of people admired her, but those same people, as well as the ones who still held reservations about her, wouldn't be able to resist the sight of her disgrace. Stillwater residents had been the rubberneckers to her car wreck of a life for too long to change now. The audience looked bored, and Ellie couldn't blame them. She glanced at the clock above the sound room window. 15 more minutes. She steeled herself to pay attention to Doyle so she could rebut, when she saw Jack through the sound booth window. She didn't need to see clearly to know it was him. She knew his stance, the slope of his shoulders. His hands were in his pockets, absently jingling his keys, she had no doubt. But his eyes were on her. The memory of those eyes raking over her, possessively, appreciatively, made her skin tingle. A welcome change from the intermittent nausea that plagued her all day. His hair was longer, a little disheveled, as though he'd been running his fingers through it. The long, square-tipped fingers that had skimmed along her skin like,
"Ms. York Martin!"
The debate monitor's nasally voice clawed through her consciousness, like fingernails on a chalkboard. "Yes?"
"Your rebuttal?"
"Of course. The debate." In the audience, Julie McBride rose, walked up the aisle, and out the door. Ellie smiled at the moderator.
"I'm sorry, Leo. What was the question again? I was too busy reliving my sordid past to take much notice of the points Joe tried to make. Or maybe I'm correct in assuming his point was to merely distract this audience and me from the real issues."
Jack couldn't breathe. Could she see him? Ellie returned her focus to the moderator and broke the connection. Had there been a connection, or did he just want there to be one? She couldn't possibly know he was here, at this spot, amid the hundreds of people in the audience. Now that he'd looked at her, he couldn't stop. Though more than 100 feet separated them, Jack knew the brown flecks in Ellie's green eyes were accentuated by the conservative camel-colored dress she wore, whose square neckline revealed enough to entice the men without offending the women. It dipped a shade lower than the First Baptist congregants would think appropriate, but the gemstone flag pin on her left breast and the single strand of pearls made up for it. The classically tailored dress stopped a few inches above the knee, but Jack's gaze continued down past her toned calves to the nude patent leather 4-inch heels. Jack knew every red-blooded man in the audience had entertained the fantasy of seeing Ellie in nothing but those pearls, shoes, and the reading glasses she held in her left hand. It kinda pissed him off. "What did Doyle say about basketball?" Jack said, not taking his eyes off Ellie. Miner nodded to the audience. "Here comes your wife." Julie McBride smiled at him as she walked up the aisle. Talk about a study in contrasts. Where Ellie was tall and elegant, Julie was petite and a bundle of barely constrained energy. Jack wasn't surprised in the least. She had been able to zone in on where he was, despite his best efforts at being incognito. He should have left earlier, or not come at all. Ellie's easy smile was now strained. Julie entered the video booth without knocking and coughed.
"It smells like smoke in here."
"I told you we were at a fire."
"Right. Hey, Miner. Good to see you."
She smiled broadly at Jack's deputy, but the smile didn't reach her eyes.
"You too,"
Miner said with a goofy, embarrassed grin. Julie had that effect on people. Even men like Miner, who were usually deceptively astute in reading people. Jack wanted to slap Miner and tell him Julie thought he was a rube without the sense God gave a slug.
"Hi, honey."
She hugged Jack. The top of her head barely brushed the knot of his tie. He squeezed her briefly in return, grasped her elbow gently, and pulled her away from him as discreetly as possible. She coughed and waved her hand in front of her face.
God, that's awful.
Miner was about to tell me about Doyle's basketball comment.
He doesn't like Ellie much, does he?
Julie said with a wry smile.
If Big Jake, Ellie's dad, would have gotten Ellie's property away from her, Miner said, Doyle was set to buy it. Still hasn't forgiven her for having a backbone.
The championship, Jack said.
Ellie was accused of throwing the championship game. Point shaven.
Jack's head jerked back. Impossible.
She was the star. Had the sweetest shot you've ever seen, Miner said. She was money at the free throw line. Something like 92% and still holds the UIL record for three-pointers, I think.
Impressive, Julie said.
So, when she had a horrible game, people wondered, but no one believed it. Didn't help Big Jake was the biggest bookie in York County. Everyone assumed he put money on the game. The coach kept her in until the end. With time winding down and losing by 10, Big Jake was poised to win thousands.
He bet against his daughter? Julie asked.
He was a son of a bitch, Miner said matter-of-factly. Game's all but over. Ellie takes the ball down the court. Everyone had given up, her team, the other team. She walked down the court unopposed. She stepped inside the three-point line and dribbled once, twice, as the clock ticked down. 5 seconds, 4 seconds. At 3 seconds, she stepped behind the three-point line and let it fly.
Jack leaned forward. There was a small smile on Miner's face.
Most beautiful shot I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of basketball, he said. Everyone in that field house held their breath as the ball arced through the air.
Did she make it? Jack said.
What kind of story would it be if she missed?
She covered the spread, didn't she?
Yep.
She went against her father? Julie said, flabbergasted.
Julie was too much of a daddy's girl to understand or condone a child betraying a parent's wishes.
Of course she did, Miner said. She's as honest as the day is long.
I guess, Julie said, still unconvinced. Jack, can I see you outside for a minute?
Jack opened the door for Julie.
Bye, Miner,
Julie said with a broad smile. When the door closed behind them, Julie's smile fell from her face like a rock slide.
When did you get here?
5 or 10 minutes ago.
I saved you a seat.
I didn't want to disturb the debate. Julie scoffed.
It's a fucking city council debate.
It's important to the people here, and I wanted to respect that.
Oh, and I didn't? Is that what you're saying?
That wasn't what I was saying or even implying, Julie.
That's what it sounded like to me.
Jack put his clenched hands in his pockets. Change the subject. Move on. I didn't see Ethan. Is he here?
No, he was at Troy's doing homework.
For someone who wanted his parents to mend fences to restore the three of them to a happy family, Ethan was conspicuously absent from home a lot of the time. Jack was torn between wanting Ethan to spend time with his new friends, Troy, Olivia, and Mitra, and wanting Ethan to spend time with his mother to see that the last year without her hadn't been so bad after all. If Jack was honest, he missed having Ethan to himself, spending time with his moody 14-year-old son. He wondered if Ethan missed him, or if he'd even noticed they'd barely seen each other these last few weeks. I thought he said he would get extra credit for attending, Jack said. Julie shrugged.
Guess it wasn't worth it. Anyway, I want him to like me, not hate me for dragging him to this snooze fest. Your brother's here, though. Right down front, supporting his girlfriend.
Is he? Screw putting in an appearance with the community. The last thing Jack wanted was to run into Ellie with Julie connected to his hip.
Listen, I have to get back to the fire scene.
Can't Miner take charge?
No. Her face softened and she moved close to him. She ran her hand up and down the smooth silk fabric of his tie. She bit her bottom lip and dropped her voice into the sexy baby doll timbre he knew so well.
We've only made love twice since I came back. You know we work best when we have that.
When Julie turned on this persona, Jack could easily forget that hatred made his heart race when he was near Julie, instead of desire. Maybe I want more than sex, Julie. Her laugh was harsh.
You didn't before.
Before? I didn't know there could be more. He looked away. Why did you come back?
I told you. I missed my family.
Bullshit.
Jack, you and Ethan are the world to me. Tell me what you want and I'll do it.
Though they were alone in the foyer, Jack lowered his voice to a harsh whisper.
I want for the last year to have never happened. To not have had to lie to Ethan for a year about where you were, why you left. To never have been suspected of murdering you. To not have lost my career because you decided you wanted to find yourself. Can you do any of those things?
She sighed dramatically and rolled her eyes.
You ruined my life, Julie. You're delusional if you think I'll take you back with open arms.
Well, let me know when you're done punishing me,
she said. I'm not punishing you.
Then what do you call this? Because it's not a marriage.
The auditorium doors opened. Julie moved to Jack's side and intertwined her arm with his to meet the Stillwater residents, her demeanor now one of an enthusiastic resident. Jack's soft response was lost amid the rumble of the crowd.
I call this temporary.
Chapter 4 Ellie walked to the center of the stage, hand outstretched. She met Joe Doyle's wolfish grin with a firm grip and a broad, fake smile.
You bastard,
Ellie said through gritted teeth.
Welcome to the big leagues, Elliot.
They held each other's hands and smiled while the newspaper photographer took their picture. As soon as she gave them the all-done thumbs up, Ellie dropped Doyle's hand, but the smile remained for the benefit of the lingering audience.
Was that necessary?
No, but it was fun, Doyle said.
You lost as many votes as you gained by dredging up my past. It made you look small, Joe. Worse, you looked desperate.
Oh, I don't think so.
Of course you don't. You were too busy being pleased with yourself to watch the audience.
Doyle's smile flickered. Ellie tilted her head and studied her late father's best friend.
Admit it, Joe. You're worried.
Doyle laughed and waved to someone over Ellie's shoulder.
How do you figure?
He said, scanning the audience as though her reply was so insignificant it didn't require his full attention.
If you weren't worried, you would never have called me a Democrat.
Ellie clapped him on the shoulder.
Don't worry, Joe. I'll be gracious in victory.
Ellie turned and walked off the stage, past Michelle Ryan, whose condescending grin was a mirror image of her father's, and Chris Ryan, who followed behind Michelle slowly, his head bent in concentration over his iPhone. Ellie found the gap in the musty stage curtain and edged through it to hide in the darkest part of backstage. Eyes closed, she leaned her forehead against the cold cinder block wall and tried to breathe through her racing heart. Hoping for proof of a fever and justification for the sick feeling she'd had all day, she pressed her hands against her cheeks. She was disappointed. She wasn't sick. She was stupid. Maybe a little bit pathetic. Okay, both. The bravado she showed with Doyle was bullshit, and he knew it as well as she did. But if nothing else came of this quixotic campaign, at least Ellie finally got to call Joe Doyle a bastard to his face, something she'd wanted to do for years. It was cold comfort when what she really wanted to do was to crush him at the polls,
but she would take the small victory. She knew better than anyone a series of small, seemingly insignificant victories could lead to a coup. One had to be patient.
Hey, what are you doing back here?
Kelly Kendrick stepped out of the darkness holding Ellie's notepad, a worried expression on her face. Ellie smiled.
Reliving old memories. Do you feel okay?
Kelly asked. She put her hand on Ellie's forehead.
There were times you looked like you were going to puke out there. Was it that obvious?
Kelly shrugged.
Probably just to me.
Ellie appreciated her friend lying to make her feel better. If Ellie were a better friend, she would tell Kelly what made her want to vomit wasn't the debate, or even Joe Doyle's character assassination, but the sight of Jack McBride's silhouette in the sound room window and his wife walking out of the auditorium to meet him.
I think I might be coming down with something,
Ellie said.
I've felt bad all day.
Kelly nodded to the exit sign glowing from the shadows.
Want to sneak out back? More than anything, but I can't.
Kelly nodded and handed Ellie the legal pad.
You did good. Doyle looked like an asshole for bringing all that stuff up. He is an asshole. You don't need to be a city councilwoman to make a difference in this town. You know it, and I know it.
Kelly held out her arms and waved her hands.
Come here.
Ellie let her oldest friend hug her. Kelly squeezed and patted her on the back like a mother would.
Everyone in this town loves and respects you. They tolerate Doyle.
Ellie squeezed Kelly and released her before the urge to cry overcame her.
Thanks. Let's go glad hand the masses.
Arm in arm, they walked onto the stage and were met by Eddie McBride. His eyes lit up when he saw the two friends.
What were you two ladies doing back there? Or should I ask?
God, men are so predictable.
Kelly released Ellie's arm and walked on. Eddie and Ellie watched her go.
Why does she hate me?
They walked across the stage, down the stairs, and up the aisle.
She doesn't hate you. She hates your twin brother.
Why?
Mike Freeman.
And I'm guilty by association.
Ellie shrugged.
Does she know about you and Jack?
Eddie asked in a low whisper. Eddie opened the auditorium doors to a low roar of conversation amplified by the cinder block walls and tile floor. Ellie's eyes were drawn to Jack like a magnet. He stood with Julie and the Doyle entourage. Julie and Michelle looked over in her direction. Somehow she knew they were talking about her. Ellie turned so she was facing away from Jack.
No.
Eddie raised his eyebrows.
I thought you two were best friends.
We are.
She didn't feel like explaining why she didn't tell Kelly about her brief affair with Jack McBride, mostly because she couldn't explain it. At first, it was a matter of discretion. Jack was married, and Ellie didn't want another scandal. When Julie returned before Jack could file for divorce, Ellie and Jack decided the best thing to do was to break it off, at least until after the holidays, for Ethan's sake. It seemed pointless to tell Kelly after the fact. As time went on, the opportunity to tell Kelly faded until it was too late. Now, the first reaction from her lifelong friend wouldn't be worry over how Ellie was handling the separation, but anger at not being told earlier. Thank God people came up to Ellie and congratulated her on a job well done, saving her from a more detailed answer. Eddie stood back, hands in his pockets, like his brother, smiled and greeted people when necessary, acting more like a bodyguard than anything. When Matt Doyle walked up and shook Eddie's hand while his wife Amy hugged Ellie, a shiver ran down her spine at the coupleness of the scene. It wasn't helped by the fact Matt and Amy held hands throughout the greetings. Ellie shifted away from Eddie in case he got any ideas.
Great job, Ellie, Matt said.
He released his wife's hand and casually draped his arm across her shoulders.
I think you changed a few people's minds.
We'll see. When Ellie decided to run for city council, Matt and Amy had contacted her immediately and thrown their support behind her. On the one hand, it wasn't a surprise. Since Matt and Amy moved to town the year before, they'd been heavily involved in the Stillwater Historical Society with Ellie, and any campaign that focused on preservation and attracting young families to Stillwater would get their support. On the other hand, Matt was Joe Doyle's youngest child, the favorite according to many, and his defection had caused some strife in his family. His support of Ellie hadn't wavered, but when it came time to pull the lever, Ellie wouldn't be surprised if Matt voted for his father.
Why didn't you mention the hotel? Amy asked.
She leaned forward and whispered,
I think the news would easily shave a few old-timers from Joe's supporters.
Of all Ellie's downtown property, the Henry Hotel was the biggest thorn in her side. It had been abandoned for 20 years since the management company contracted to run it went out of business. No other company had been willing to step in and manage an out-of-date hotel with low occupancy rates. Most people in town thought Ellie should have reopened the Henry instead of opening a bookstore. Ellie knew she needed to draw businesses into town before she could justify investing the time and money into a 15-room historic hotel with lead paint and mold. As luck would have it, a friend of Ellie's in Dallas was in historic renovations and had jumped at the chance to see the Henry when she mentioned it.
I don't want to mention it until it's a done deal, Ellie said. Plus, I don't want the opposition to find out and try to sabotage us.
Good point, Matt said.
Curtis has a chef interested in opening a small restaurant.
An organic restaurant, Ellie said.
Your name might have come up.
Matt's eyes lit up.
No kidding?
He and the chef are coming on Tuesday to see the property. I know it's election day, but it's the only day that worked.
What time?
They'll be at my bookstore at 10.
I'll be there, Matt said.
He and Amy shared an excited smile.
We still on for tomorrow morning?
Ellie asked Amy. Amy inhaled in fake apprehension.
I guess, yes, we are. 4 miles?
Yep, Ellie said.
You can do it.
Of course you can,
Eddie said, winking at Amy. She blushed and glanced at her husband. Matt playfully punched Eddie in the arm.
Stop flirting with my wife.
6 weeks earlier, when Ellie's life imploded like a dying star, she had jumped at Amy's shy request to run together. Amy wanted to lose weight, and Ellie needed to get out of her head for an hour and focus on someone else. Amy was a bit of a chatterbox, and a well-placed question would send her off to the races. Ellie thought for sure Amy would run out of conversation eventually, but so far she hadn't. Ellie, a solitary runner for years, was surprised at how much she enjoyed running with Amy. Julie McBride pushed into the small group, a bright smile on her perfectly symmetrical face.
Great job, Ellie.
Julie looked like the quintessential John Hughes movie villainess, the girl everyone hated but was too afraid of to confront. Ellie stared down at the petite woman and guessed she could pick up Julie with one arm and hurl her across the foyer with ease. Ellie inched away from Jack's wife before she acted on the urge and forced herself to be polite.
Thanks, Julie. Do you know Matt and Amy Doyle?
No.
Ellie made the introductions. She stepped back while they made small talk and was plotting her escape when Julie said,
Miner told me and Jack about your basketball scandal.
Matt and Amy stilled. Ellie's smile stiffened. Everyone in town knew the story, but no one talked about it. At least, not to her face.
Did he? It took courage to go against your family like that.
You'd know all about that, I suppose.
The jibe was out of her mouth before Ellie could stop herself. When Julie arrived in town a week after Jack and his son, Ethan, The town swallowed Julie's story of being on a family-approved, year-long sabbatical like sweet tea on a hot summer day. Ellie was the only person in town who knew the truth. Ellie hurried to cover her snide comment. The difference being you have a supportive, forgiving family. My father never liked me much, so it didn't take as much courage as you think. Julie's eyes narrowed, her face a mask of forced good humor.
Did your father ever forgive you?
No. He hated me until the day he died. Better him hating me than losing my self-respect. I've never regretted it.
How admirable.
The word twisted from her mouth. More insult than compliment.
Jack and I barely know you, but we know you'd never do something like throw a game.
You'd be shocked at how well your husband knows me.
Thank you.
Yeah, first impressions are usually bang on, aren't they, Jules?
Eddie said. Julie turned to Eddie and narrowed her eyes.
Oh, I didn't notice you there, Eddie.
Sure you didn't.
If you'll excuse me,
Ellie said. She felt sorry abandoning Amy and Matt, but they were by far the best people to handle Julie McBride. They would chit-chat about inconsequential stuff and let Julie lead the conversation around to her favorite subject, herself. Not paying attention to where she was going, only the urge to get away, she pretended to wave at someone across the room and ran straight into Jack. Her legal pad fell out of her hand and slid across the floor.
Oh.
Their eyes met, and the leap of her heart triggered the memory of the first time she had been this close to him. How the bright lights from the football field threw his bruised face into shadow. How vulnerable he'd seemed. How she had been desperate to escape him, and whatever it was she felt. Now she wanted to bury her face in his neck, to nuzzle the soft spot behind his ear, and breathe in his pine-tinged woodsy cologne, which sent tingles up and down the inside of her left leg.
Christ almighty, you're in the middle of the high school, get a grip.
Jack stepped back, picked up her legal pad, and read the message on the top page. His eyebrow quirked into an incredulous arch. He pulled the page off, folded it, and put it in his coat pocket. I'll trash this for you. Ellie stepped toward him and away from the group. She took the legal pad and was impressed by how strong and clear her voice sounded when she thanked him. Ellie stared at the cleft in his chin and felt herself leaning toward him, as if an inexorable force pulled them together. She crossed her arms and pretended Jack was any other citizen talking to her about the election.
Why do you smell like smoke?
Do you know the one-armed soldier's home?
Out on 107? Yeah.
It burned to the ground.
I suppose it's a blessing in disguise.
Jack leaned forward and whispered.
Except for the two bodies inside.
Ellie's eyes widened.
Any ideas?
Not very good ones. You know Paco Morales?
Name doesn't ring a bell. Was he?
Jack shrugged.
Maybe.
I thought you knew everyone in town, he said with a wry smile.
Almost.
I don't need to tell you to keep this between us, do I?
No.
Didn't think so.
His gaze subtly traveled down and up her figure.
I like your dress.
Ellie looked down at the tan dress and touched her mother's pearls.
I look like Barbara Bush.
Jack chuckled. I guarantee you no man in that audience thought of Barbara Bush when they looked at you. She laughed and leaned forward conspiratorially.
I guarantee you, you were the only one thinking naughty thoughts.
Good. She shook her head and glanced at the group behind them. Kelly had joined the group and eyed Ellie suspiciously, but thankfully Julie's back was turned. Somehow she and Jack had managed to avoid the attention of any of the other citizens. Ellie didn't know if she should be happy for the time with Jack, or upset, none of the residents cared enough about her campaign to talk to her. She decided to enjoy what conversation she could steal with Jack and try to prolong it as long as possible.
How's your secret project going?
Their last night together, Jack had told her about Pollard's journals and sworn her to secrecy. I'm learning more about the residents of Stillwater than I ever wanted to know.
As long as you don't use it against anyone.
You know me better than that. Her eyes slid down to his lips.
I do.
It came out as a hoarse whisper. She dropped her gaze to the yellow legal pad, cleared her throat, and forced herself to meet his eyes.
I need to tell you.
The rapid clicks of a camera interrupted her. The newspaper photographer was taking a picture of the group behind Ellie. Relief washed through her. Wouldn't that be the cherry on top of a disastrous night? A photo catching Ellie mooning at Jack McBride while his wife stood 2 feet away. What? Jack said in a low, urgent voice. He touched her arm. What do you need to tell me? She pulled her arm away, but not before the familiar jolt of desire shot through her. She needed to get away from him.
Later. Thanks for coming,
Ellie said and moved away. Chapter 5. Jack was so bleary-eyed from his all-nighter, he almost ran over the drunk stumbling down the shoulder of Boondoggle Road. The first time Jack stopped Fred Muldoon, he suspected he was being punked, that Fred was like all the other friends of Buck Pollard's who had made it their mission in life to waste as much of Jack's time as possible on groundless complaints. A few incoherent sentences into the conversation, and Jack knew Fred didn't have the faculties to carry off any sort of grand plan, unless the grand plan was begging for money at the corner of Main and Old Yorkville and buying a fifth of Old Crow with the proceeds. Jack rolled down the window of his cruiser.
Fred, what are you doing out at this time of night?
That you, Chief?
Yeah, Fred. What are you doing out here on the highway?
Walking.
Walking where?
Wherever.
Jack pulled off on the shoulder in front of Fred and got out.
Come on, I'll take you home.
Jack grasped Fred's arm as he stumbled forward.
Have you eaten anything today?
It's tomorrow.
Fred nodded to something over Jack's shoulder. The chief turned and saw a tinge of light breaking over the horizon.
So it is, Jack said.
He opened the back door to the squad car.
Come on, I'll buy you a honey bun.
I ain't hungry, but I'm thirsty.
Then I'll buy you a coffee. Abe'll have it on fresh, I bet.
Abe ain't brewed a good pot of coffee since 1976.
I didn't say it would be good, I said it would be fresh.
When Jack was settled in the front and driving off, Fred said,
Why are you out patrolling at the crack of dawn? Ain't that some probie's job?
I like to pull my weight. And avoid my wife.
Jack turned into the Chevron and parked beneath the blazing lights.
Be right back.
The convenience store was empty, save the large man behind the counter. Abe wore the same thing he'd worn every day Jack had walked through the doors. Dingy overalls, an international harvester hat, and a scraggly beard.
Abe?
Chief?
Jack made a beeline for the coffee counter, poured 2 large cups, and picked up a couple of honey buns on the way to the register. Abe rang Jack up.
You really like them honey buns. I've had to buy a new case just last week. First time in years.
Jack paused. How old were the ones I've been eating?
Oh, they weren't out of date. Don't you worry.
When Jack didn't move, Abe continued.
You never got sick, did you?
No.
Then there you go. That Fred Muldoon you got in the car there?
Yeah.
Huh. I figured for sure he's one of the bodies you found out at the old soldier's home.
Fred lives over on Birch.
Abe screwed up his face.
Fred ain't lived on Birch Street in 30 years. Don't live nowhere as far as I know. ID'd those bodies yet?
It's only been 15 hours, Abe. Jack held up the buns. Thanks.
See you tomorrow.
Jack put the buns in his pocket, picked up the coffees, and left. He got in the car and tossed the two honey buns into Fred's lap. Fred held one of his shoes and was staring at the sole. The car smelled like stale Fritos. Jesus, put on your shoe, Fred.
I need new soles.
Jack rolled down the windows to get some air flowing. You need to wash your feet.
Probably.
He put his shoe back on and held up a honey bun.
Don't you want one?
I'm good. Jack drove out of the parking lot. Abe seemed to think you were one of those bodies out at the one-armed soldier's home.
I've flopped out there before.
Flopped out there lately?
Nah, too many meth heads. Those people are crazy. I miss the hippies. Stoned and happy and fucking anyone willing.
Hear any chatter about who the two unlucky ones might be?
Nope.
Fred finished the honey buns and was blowing on the surface of his coffee. He looked at Jack in the rearview mirror.
Surely that ain't it.
Now, Fred, Jack said, feigning offense, do you think I feed you so I could pump you for information?
It ain't the only reason you're nice to me, but it's a big part of it. Don't matter. As long as you give me my fee.
You aren't spending your CI money on booze, are you?
Course not. Groceries and bills. Like I promised.
They went along with the lie because their relationship was mutually beneficial. Fred told Jack rumors he wouldn't normally hear, and Fred got to retain some dignity by not having to beg for drinking money. What's the word on the street, Fred?
Doyle's first order of business when he wins is to get you fired and put Miner in as chief. Probably fire your two new minorities, too. Why'd you hire the Mexican anyway? Ain't you fluent? Your mom's Mexican, ain't she?
Officer Malik is highly qualified. Speaking Spanish is a bonus. Jack parked in front of the house on Birch he'd been dropping Fred off at for weeks. Seen Kyle Grant around? Fred stopped blowing on his coffee and looked at Jack over the rim, his eyes calculating. Interesting, Jack thought. Kyle Grant was a two-bit local hoodlum who'd followed in his father's footsteps down to Huntsville for assault and battery. He graduated from the Pen harder and meaner, with rumored ties to the Tex SS, a white supremacist prison gang with tentacles into the civilian world for drugs, girls, numbers, and murder for hire. For the last few weeks, Kyle Grant's name had come up occasionally, reluctantly, in minor drug busts around Stillwater. Fidgety meth heads were too scared to say Kyle supplied the meth, or showed them how to cook it in batches, or even ask them to go around town buying up the ingredients.
Why don't you ask your secretary, Susan? She's married to Kyle's brother, Fred said.
They don't have a close relationship, I gather.
Rightly so. Brian Grant might be an unlucky son of a bitch, but he ain't stupid. It's an example you ought to take to heart. Kyle Grant is a mean motherfucker, like his dad.
I appreciate the concern, Fred, but my job is to catch the mean motherfuckers, not avoid them. Fred sipped his coffee, then said,
I hear Kyle's branched out into heroin.
Where is he getting it?
I ain't that tuned in. I stick to whiskey. It's legal and cheap. And I don't want to know. Quickest way to the grave getting involved with drugs. Case in point, those two crispy critters at the one-armed soldier's house. Your brother better hope one was Kyle.
Why?
Kyle has it out for Eddie. Thinks he's pushing in on his scene.
I hope you're talking about his job at Doyle's Produce Company. Fred laughed.
Shit! Kyle don't work for Matt. He splits his time working between the heavy equipment business and the country club.
Where'd you hear this about Kyle and Eddie? Fred lifted his eyes from his coffee, looking more sober than Jack had ever seen him.
Here and there. Scraps on the street.
Fred leaned forward and held out his hand. Tell me who said it. Fred shook his head.
You may not think so, but my life is worth more than a honey bun and a cup of coffee.
Jack pulled out his money clip and removed 3 20s. He held one of them out of Fred's reach. Who? Fred licked